Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of May. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about what's happened in Britain. They have their first coalition in decades, and the new UK Prime Minister, David Cameron, has said that this could mark a historic and seismic shift in British politics. The coalition is the first time the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats have had a power-sharing deal at Westminster and the first coalition in the UK since the Second World War. This all happened so rapidly, we're not used to this. It goes on and on and on in the United States, but Mr. Cameron's arrival in Downing Street does mark the end of 13 years of Labour rule and power transferred quite quickly, with Gordon Brown saying that he was leaving yesterday, and then today Mr. Cameron announcing at his first press conference this historic and seismic shift. The Conservative leader is 6 months younger than Tony Blair was when he won power in 1997 and is the youngest prime minister since 1812. The Conservatives won the most seats in last week's general election, but not enough to secure an overall Commons majority, resulting in a hung parliament. The Liberal Democrats, the third largest party in the United Kingdom, held days for 5 days of talks with the Conservatives and the Labour Party, who won the second highest number of seats. A deal was reached yesterday that resulted, as you know, in Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown resigning. Mr. Cameron has begun appointing his first cabinet, and several of those are Liberal Democrats. We're going to be talking about all of this the first hour of our program. We're lining up our guests momentarily, and we will get them on the air and talk with them about what's going on here and the issues that they need to face. They have a very large deficit in England. We'll be talking about taxes and services, whether or not vital services, and I guess healthcare is considered a vital service in England, will be on the table for cuts or not, and how you get two fairly disparate parties to form a coalition. It's a much different kind of government. Where do they stand when they are labeled the Liberal Democrats? What exactly does that mean? How is their philosophy different than the Labour Party? So we'll have two guests with us. And as soon as we line them up, we will be on the air with them. The second hour of our program today, Murder City, Charles Bowden will be joining us. Ciudad Juarez and the global economy's new killing fields. This is a remarkable story. Juarez, he says, has long supplied Americans with what they wanted. Booze during Prohibition, women at all times, opiates when they were outlawed in the United States, quick divorces when the marriage is soured. And like the rest of Mexico, the city has operated as a partnership between criminal organizations and government. And he looks at Juarez, which is now probably the murder capital of the entire world. It's quite a read. Charles is the critically acclaimed author of many books, including Down by the River, A Shadow in the City, and Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing. He is a contributing editor for GQ, Munther Jones, and also writes for Harper's Magazine, the New York Times Book Review, and he lives in Tucson, Arizona. He has spent a number of years, probably a good 15 years, looking at what's going on in Juarez, and he takes on the issue of NAFTA, he takes on the issue of immigration. It should be a very good hour, and that will be coming up the second hour of our program. Both hours, you are welcome to join us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We're still lining up our guests for the first hour of the program today. I guess I can give you their backgrounds, and then we'll get them on the air shortly. Joining us shortly, Professor Paul Whiteley. Professor Whiteley is a director of the master's program in public opinion and polling in the Department of Government at the University of Essex. Professor Whiteley has written extensively about British politics, the Labour Party in crisis, political control of the macro economy, and current research includes British political parties, electoral behavior, political economy, and the comparative analysis of citizenship and social capital. We will also be speaking with Professor Paul Webb, and he is at the University of Sussex, has held a number of visiting positions in Britain and abroad, including in Australia. His latest book is Party Politics in New Democrats, and he will join us momentarily. So we start our conversation with Professor Paul Whiteley from the University of Essex. Professor Whiteley, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
One thing that is so surprising to us, because it takes us forever to make a transition in power, is how this happened. Well, there were 4 days of negotiations, but all of a sudden, your Prime Minister Brown is resigning, and the next day, the new Prime Minister is up and running. It just happens immediately, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a sudden death system and can be brutal. You have to get your furniture out of number 10, Downing Street, and the newcomer moves in very rapidly. So the transition is very short.
Yes. Well, tell me about this big change now. What is historic about this election?
Well, coalition governments, which is what we have now, are unusual in Britain. And usually they're associated with big crises, wars, and so on. And some of them have been successful and others not so. And this is what makes it so unusual. We had a very successful coalition government headed by Winston Churchill, of course, during the Second World War. And this brought Britain through the war. There was a much less successful coalition government after the First World War in the early 1920s between the Liberals and the Conservatives at that time, and that broke up and really wasn't very effective. So we've had a history of coalitions, but they usually are associated with a major crisis, whereas this one is a product of a hung parliament rather than a major crisis.
Tell me about the political philosophies, because those of us on the other side of the large pond, when we hear the phrases the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats are forming a coalition government, which they have, do they have wildly different political philosophies? How do they form a coalition?
Yes, roughly speaking, if you imagine politics being left and right, you know, where in the U.S. context, of course, Democrats are on the left or center-left and Republicans on the right or center-right, then the Conservative Party is the center-right party in Britain. The Labour Party, the party that's just lost the election, is the center-left party. And the Liberal Democrats are a centrist party in between these two. Now, that's a little bit of a simplification, because on some policies, the parties are in different places. But overall, that gives you a sense of what the party system is like. And then there's, in addition, smaller parties associated with Scotland and Wales. But the three major parties are the Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, and Labour.
Mm-hmm. So what were the people in England saying about Gordon Brown, and what were they saying about David Cameron? Why have the Conservatives returned to power?
Well, there's a number of factors, and the background to it is, I suppose, 13 years of a Labour government. And after a while, and this is true in other countries as well as Britain, people get tired with an administration. It looks tired, it runs out of ideas, and potentially they want to change. And there's been some research suggesting that being in government automatically for any party incurs costs. It's a sort of costs of government argument, that over time, gradually people get fed up with you and want to change, and this accumulates and eventually brings a change in an election. But I think the other point, too, is there's no question that people have been very concerned about the financial crisis, as I'm sure they have in the United States, and economic issues dominate. Now, Labour was showing signs of having coped with this economic crisis that we've been going through, but the recovery is still very uncertain in Britain, as it is in the United States. And I think there's a feeling among people that they needed a new face, and the Conservatives would come in and tackle this problem better than the old parties. And then the third thing is, on the whole, people didn't like Gordon Brown very much. He was regarded as a rather dour Scot, and David Cameron was a fresh face, the Conservative leader, spoke very well in speeches and in during the campaign. And Gordon Brown didn't help himself very much by being caught out in the campaign criticising an ordinary voter he'd just talked to. He assumed the microphone was off, and he was caught saying that this ordinary voter was a bigot, and this caused a bit of a row and
made him look
like a hypocrite. So one or two things like this all accumulated to produce this election result. It should be said it was not a disaster for Labour. You know, they just lost.
Right.
And therefore they're in a position to come back in due course if they rethink their positions and get a new leader, which they're in the process of doing. So it's not a complete disaster for Labour, but on the other hand, it looks as though they'll be in opposition for some years.
Mm-hmm. Politicians need to learn that the microphone may always be on.
Yes,
don't
that's
you think?
Right.
they must learn that. Also joining our conversation is Professor Paul Webb, and he is at the University of Sussex. He's a professor of politics there and has held a number of previous and visiting positions in Britain and abroad, most recently at the Australian National University. Professor Paul Webb, thank you so much for joining us right now. Hi, thanks so much.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for being with us. Your overall response to the elections, did you predict that this was going to happen, or did you think something completely different would happen?
No, I think one has to say in fairness that the opinion polls have been very clear for a long time that the outcome was likely to be a hung parliament. So to that extent, I wasn't very surprised. With respect to the actual outcome in terms of the government that's emerged, that's a little more surprising. It wasn't entirely obvious that Liberal Democrats and Conservatives were, you know, good bedfellows, so to speak, because the way things have gone in British politics over the last few decades, it seems more and more the case that really the British Liberal Party and then their successors, the modern Liberal Democrats, were really a centre-left progressive force who were perhaps more naturally inclined to ally themselves to the Labour Party.
Mm-hmm. We should spend a little bit of time talking about Nick Clegg, the head of the Liberal Democrats. Give me a little bit of his background. He's also very young, so you have these marvelous pictures of these two young, vigorous people taking over what looks like a new generation of political leaders in England.
Yes, I mean, Clegg is, you're right. I mean, he's 43, I believe, same age as Cameron. Like Cameron, he went to one of the country's elite schools. He went to Westminster School, just down the road from where he's working now, of course. He has a background, really, I mean, he's one of those people who really spent much of his life actually working in politics or in public affairs, in the charitable sector and so on. But he worked in the European Union. He was trained at the College of Europe in Bruges, in Belgium, and is, like so many Liberal Democrats, is actually a strong pro-European in terms of his general orientation. He only got into Parliament a few years ago, and within a few years of getting into Parliament, actually acceded to the leadership of the party, beating Chris Huhne, who is now going to be the new Environment and Climate Change Secretary in the new government, for the leadership of the party.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of him, Professor Whiteley?
Well, we had for the first time in Britain, as surprising as this might sound to an American audience, a national debate between the leaders. We've not succeeded in doing this, whereas in the United States, of course, they've been done ever since 1960. And it's fair to say that the Liberal Democrat leader, Clegg, ran away with the first debate. He was greatly impressed many of the listeners and voters. And so their voting ratings went up very rapidly, actually by 10%.
Oh, my goodness.
Immediately after the debate. And lots of people watched this debate because it had such novelty value. Now, it's fair to say that the actual vote came down subsequently. So it was something of a temporary thing. But it really put him in the public eye and attracted a lot of attention to the Liberal Democrats, which in part has helped them to get the number of MPs they've succeeded in getting elected.
Why did you have to wait until 2010 to have a television debate?
Well, there's a funny paradox about this. Incumbents always say, well, we won't do this because it's too risky. And we're giving a platform to our challengers. And so in the past, they've always made excuses for avoiding it. It came about this time because Gordon Brown, the old prime minister and incumbent, was behind in the polls. And so he felt that it was too risky not to do this. The Conservatives, of course, who were in opposition, wanted to have the debate, and it would give the platform for David Cameron. And they really didn't expect Nick Clegg to be quite so popular and quite so spectacular in his debating skills. And so this was a bit of a wild card in the election and made it very interesting.
Professor Webb, it must have been fun to watch that. Now you're going to have debates all the time, right?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, speaking as a citizen rather than as a political scientist, I have to say that I was really impressed by the first debate because it was, of course, it was confrontational in many senses in terms of debating the issues, but I actually thought it was really well conducted, that there was a serious level of debate sustained over 90 minutes that you don't often get in British television programmes, still less do you get them actually in Parliament, in parliamentary debates. And, you know, the sort of flagship current affairs debate program that you get in on the BBC is something called Question Time, which comes on once a week. And even that has something of the bear pit atmosphere about it, with people heckling from the audience and clapping and cheering. And you didn't get that. And actually, I think, although some people criticize that, I actually think it lent it more of a kind of reasoned, rational aura, basically. It came across as a really serious, interesting thing. And I really do think it actually enhanced the democratic quality of the election campaign.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both of you. We are talking about the elections in Britain and, of course, the change of government, which has happened in the last couple of days as a result of the election. The Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, I should put that in the reverse order, the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, because the Conservatives had the most votes, were able to form a coalition government, and it's rather historic in Britain for this to happen. So the Conservatives are on board in power for the first time since 1997, and Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats and will be active participants in the new coalition, having received a number of the positions announced today. We need to look a little bit more at what the issues that are that Britain is dealing with, and we will do that in just a moment. Welcoming your phone calls as well. Excuse me if we've been a little discombobulated here today. We had a fire drill, and we didn't know what was going on, and the lights are flashing here in the studio, and so it's been a little wild. But everything is calm now. It was a false alarm, so we are back on track. I hope you didn't notice it on the air. We tried to remain cool. Here's the number again, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that. It is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Both our guests are joining us by phone from England today, Professor Paul Whiteley, Professor of Politics and Government at the University of Essex, and Professor Paul Webb is also with us, Professor of Politics at the University of Sussex. 800-486-8655 is the number. Carl from Madison is our first caller. Hi, Carl.
Hi. About 9 million, exactly, or precisely 9,442 years ago, I took a comparative government course in college. And two of the things that I remember were that, number one, Britain has a very strong professional civil service system. And two, this allows them to, whichever party gains control, to quickly switch governments. Added to that, there is what's called a shadow government. And I believe those still are in place, and maybe your guest could comment on that for us as bloody colonials here.
Thank you, Carl, for the call. Who wants to start?
Well, perhaps I could just say quickly, yeah, it's absolutely right that we don't have anything like the sort of six-week period of transition from one administration to another that the Americans have after a U.S. presidential election. It's really quite brutal. I mean, the minute the election result is over and a prime minister has to resign, that's it. He and his family are out, and the next one moves in. And, of course, it was a little bit different this time because there was the uncertainty after the Thursday night's election results about exactly who was going to be the next prime minister. So there were a few days of dithering, if you like. But once it was decided that Gordon Brown was going to resign, that was it. He went, and Cameron was in, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Professor Whiteley?
Well, your call is quite right. The new government will have a cabinet, and that's the basis of British government. And, of course, unlike the United States, the executive arises directly out of Parliament, and there isn't a separate elected executive, which is why it's very important to have a government in place, and make sure the transition works. The executive arises directly from Parliament, and the largest party, or in this case, the largest combination of parties with the most seats, controls the executive and indeed controls Parliament. So the opposition party, which is now Labour, will form its own shadow government. In other words, it'll have ministers in the various departments of state whose task is to be the counterparts to the actual ministers in the Conservative, Liberal, Democrat government. And that's what the shadow cabinet means. So, if you like, the opposition party's waiting for office at any one point of time, and if there's an election, can, so to speak, take over very rapidly. And it makes for this very fast transition that Paul mentioned just a moment ago.
And tell me again, I know this, but I can't remember, what prompts that new election?
Well, in fact, constitutionally, there has to be an election within 5 years of the previous one, but the Prime Minister can go to the Queen and ask for a dissolution of Parliament and trigger a new election at any time during this five-year period. So there's no fixed-term parliaments as such. Those of us who study elections, it makes it very nervous. Our American colleagues know when there's going to be a presidential election.
Yes.
And can prepare to study it. We've got to be ready and waiting at any one point of time because we might be caught out by a quick election. Now, in fact, one of the proposals that the new government is considering is to introduce fixed-term parliaments, which will change this. But up to this point, it's been possible to have an election pretty much at any time. And there's been several occasions when elections were took place relatively shortly after previous elections and didn't go the full 4 or 5 years term. Happened in 1974 and happened again in between 1964 and 66. So it makes politics very interesting.
Professor Webb, what do you think of the idea of fixed-term parliaments?
I mean, it is interesting. As Paul was saying, it's quite an innovation in the British system. I mean, the strength of it is, I suppose, from a democratic point of view, that it is seen as taking away something which is regarded as giving the incumbent prime minister a bit of an unfair advantage, because the incumbent prime minister can look to the time when he or she thinks that things are going well for his government, her government, and can ask for a dissolution and try and exploit the advantage, and maybe can manipulate the economy to time, you know, well with the dissolution of Parliament and so on and so forth. So it's come to be regarded more and more as a thing which somehow is you know, not quite fair in a democratic sense. It has to be said, you've got to be a little bit careful with it, though, because they're talking about a five-year fixed parliament now, which is quite a long time between elections.
Yes.
They do. It's about the same as France, actually, for parliamentary elections. Now, if there is a kind of governing crisis during that period, and for some reason a government should lose its majority in the Commons, then you could be faced with the prospect of a bit of a lame duck administration struggling on until the 5 years is up and not being able to call another election. That said, I mean, my understanding is there is going to be some kind of a provision in the new proposal that that you can actually dissolve Parliament before the 5 years and call fresh elections if there is a sort of super majority vote of 55% or more in favour of that in the House of Commons. But that's going to come down to politics, you know, the kind of balance, calculations of the balance of advantage between different parties.
Now, was this part of the deal? I have read that the Conservatives, in having their talks with the Liberal Democrats really want changes in the way elections are held. What changes were they asking for? Was a fixed-term parliament part of their deal or not?
Well, it is one of the things that's been, that they favoured as part of the package of political reforms. The thing that they have most wanted, the Liberal Democrats have most wanted for a long time, is a system of proportional representation in elections for the House of Commons. Currently, the first-past-the-post electoral system in 650 Westminster constituencies across the United Kingdom is something which the Liberal Democrats do very, very badly out of. They gain around about, you know, this last time, they, for 23% of the vote across the UK as a whole, they gained less than 10% of the seats.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's, you know, it's egregiously disproportional and unfair to the Liberal Democrats, and it is specifically the Liberal Democrats who do worst out of it. They're not the only party that does badly out of it. Actually, there's a kind of bias in the electoral system against the Conservatives, but it's not as serious as it is for the Lib Dems.
Well, how does that happen, before you go on, how does that happen?
It happens basically because the Lib Dems have got quite a widespread pattern of support across the United Kingdom as a whole, but there are not enough constituencies in which they actually are the number one candidate. They get a lot of second places, and for second, you get nothing, basically, under our system. So, you know, they want a form of PR, which is known as the single transferable vote. That's not on the table. Nobody's offering that to them. What the Conservatives have promised is that they will call for a referendum of the British people for a change to something called the alternative vote. Now, the alternative vote is not proportional representation. It is probably something out of which the Liberal Democrats would do a bit better. And what it does do is ensure that every candidate who is returned to Parliament can at least say they have the support of an absolute majority of their electors. Because to get elected, you have to get at least 50% plus one of the votes in your constituency. If you don't do that on the first preferences that voters express, then they will have been asked on a ballot paper to list all of their preferences down to as many candidates as are running, so they can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever, in order of preference. And if nobody gets 50% on the first preferences, then you kick out the bottom candidate and reallocate that person's second preferences to other candidates until somebody gets past the 50% winning post.
I see.
It's not true proportional representation, but it would make, a significant difference to election outcomes in the country.
And would you be in favour of those changes, Professor Whiteley?
Yes. There was a study a few years ago that looked across all the world's advanced industrial democracies, about 35 or 36 of them, including the United States, and worked out a measure of the distortion between the percentage of votes that are obtained by the different parties in each country in the election and the percentage of seats that they obtained in the legislature. And there's a little formula you can use to calculate the extent to which there is distortion, the extent to which these don't match up. And Britain was last in the list, with one exception. So, if you like, the mother of parliaments is very, very distorted in the way it's elected in Britain. And I think it's undermining the legitimacy of Parliament, actually. And so I think it's time to look at this again and make the system more proportional.
Let's look at some programs that may be on the chopping block as a result of the Conservatives' taxing policies that may change. Of course, we, being concerned about ourselves, some would say perhaps too much, continuation of help in Afghanistan with NATO forces and with the United States. Do you imagine any substantive changes on some of those big issues? You want to start, Professor Whiteley?
Yes. I mean, the major debate. I mean, first of all, the election was dominated by the economy, and that's no surprise. And the major debate was really how does Britain adjust to the huge debts that we've run up, in part because of the need to support the banking system and the City of London. Huge debts by government have been run up in the course of doing that. And how quickly do we pay those down? Now, there's only two ways one can go to pay these down. One is to raise taxes, which, of course, is not very popular. But the other is to cut public spending, cut spending on health and mm-hmm. education and domestic programs and, indeed, defense. And there was a debate between the outgoing Labour government that wanted to cut more slowly and the Conservatives that want to cut more rapidly. And it looks as though now there will be more rapid cuts in public spending in order to deal with this financial crisis. And the concern is that this might put the economy back into recession. People talk about double-dip recession. You know, we've come out of one recession and we might be going back into another one. And there's been talk of a similar kind in the United States. And this is the concern. How rapidly can you pay back these debts and restore fiscal prudence while not at the same time creating a new recession that's going to cause all kinds of problems of unemployment and so on? And this is a debate that's going on. And I think we'll see more rapid cuts as a result of the election outcome.
What programs do you think, Professor Webb, are sacrosanct?
Well, I was just about to add to Paul's comments and say, actually, it's very difficult, and this is not being evasive, it is quite difficult to say where they will make cuts. I mean, they have basically said they will try and protect health and education to a certain extent, but beyond that, we don't know where the axe will really fall. I mean, something that the parties were quite widely criticised for during the election campaign, not least by the Independent Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a highly respected independent research think tank in the country, was that they really hadn't set out very much detail on where the spending cuts were going to happen. I think the Liberal Democrats in their manifesto had set out more than the others, but that still only amounted to around about 25% of the required cuts. Or at least, you know, the required gap that had to be filled. And as Paul says, it can be cuts, but it can also be through tax rises. So, you know, we know a little bit about areas that are likely to be protected, and we've heard an awful lot about cutting government waste as a way of doing it, reducing these things which we call in this country quangos, which is an acronym for quasi-autonomous non-governmental organizations. They're public-funded bodies, but they spend public money, but they're not directly under the control of the state, of the central government department.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we don't have a very sharp idea yet about exactly where the cuts are going to fall.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. We're looking at the results of a change of power in Britain this hour of the program. Conservative leader David Cameron is now in charge, and talks between Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats and Conservative leader David Cameron's Conservative Party were successful. And so we have something rather historic going on in England right now. Conservatives did win 306 of the 650 seats in the House of Commons. It was short of the 326 needed for a majority. Labour won 258 seats, and the Liberal Democrats 57, and smaller parties took the rest. So we're looking at how these two parties will be able to govern in a coalition government, what that means, what their political philosophies are, and what their problems are. Some of them are similar to what we're facing here in the United States, and also getting a little bit of a lesson in how quickly things happen in England when there's a transfer of power. And one of the issues in the campaign was the way that the results are handled, and so the Liberal Democrats are calling for a change in that, and the Conservatives, as part of their deal-making, said, all right, we'll look at that. So join a conversation if you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guests are Professor Paul Whiteley, Professor of Politics and Government at the University of Essex, and Professor Paul Webb, Professor of Politics at the University of Sussex. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We have a couple emails that have come in, which we'll get to, and we'll get to more of your calls as well. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, Charles Bowden, who writes one heck of a book about an extremely troubling city, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Murder City is the name of the book. Charles spent quite a bit of time in Juarez, which because of drugs and NAFTA and a number of other issues has become the city in the world, really, with the largest murder rate. It's a very troubling story. Lawlessness. And we'll talk with him about what he has discovered, our number two. 800-486-8655. Peter from Stoughton is our next caller. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering if the institution, so to speak, of special interest lobbyists exists in the within the government of Britain, and if they have the same sort of influence that they unfortunately have here in the United States.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Professor Whiteley, you want to start?
Yes, but the system works a little bit differently in Britain from the United States. And it's to do with the issue of campaign contributions. All politicians want to raise money for campaigns. But in the United States, the cost of campaigns is enormous, as you know, largely because of the demands of television and the need to buy television 30-second commercials. Now, in Britain, it's actually not possible legally for parties to buy 30-second commercials on television. They're allocated time by the network channels to make their case. These are called party political broadcasts. And the time allocation is based upon their vote in the previous election. It's not based upon the ability to buy. So, in other words, politicians in Britain don't have to raise the kind of money that a senator or a member of the House of Representatives would have to do in the United States. And this means that the influence of lobbying is somewhat less in Britain than in the United States. The other point, too, is the party system is stronger inside Parliament, so that Labour MPs will, for most of the time, obey the whips in Parliament, go along with the party line. This is also true of Conservative MPs and Liberal Democrats. There's a little bit of rebellion going on, but it's not on the same scale as in the Senate or the House of Representatives. So, actually, the party cohesion makes it harder for lobbyists to get their special interests looked at and taken care of. You know, you can't attach special interest legislation to existing bills in Britain that will help a particular corporation or help a particular locality in quite the same way you can in Congress. So we have a problem of special interest lobbying, but I don't think it's actually on the scale of the U.S.
We go to Dave next from Madison. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, gentlemen. I have a question about the long lines at the polls and the cutoff time that left the many voters standing outside unable to cast their ballots. And I'm curious about the follow-up to that. Will there be enough of a groundswell to change the laws to allow people in line at the close-off time to vote, or will there be a push for more polling places, especially in these industrial areas?
Okay. Professor Webb?
I'm sure there's going to be something about that. I mean, there's quite a row about that. It was extraordinary. I've never encountered an election where you've got stories like this on this kind of scale before. It's clear that a number of the polling stations were taken by surprise by the sheer number of people who were trying to vote, but that's not really any excuse. And there are, you know, a few stories of constituencies where they didn't order enough ballot papers, everybody who was registered to vote on the supposition that you would never get anything like 100% turnout. And in one or two cases, my understanding is that that was actually the problem. There just weren't the ballot papers there. There was also some confusion about individual interpretations of particular officers working at the polling stations on the day as to whether people who had been queuing before the closing time of 10 o'clock should actually be allowed in, or whether they would just slam the doors on them, people who were still already in the queue, or you know, whatever. There was some inconsistency of the way that the rules were actually implemented. So, yes, the National Electoral Commission has already said straight away that there is going to be an inquiry into this, and I'm sure they'll be making recommendations.
What kind of turnout did you have in this election, and what kind of turnout do you typically have?
Well, the turnout this time nationally was around 65%. 65% 20 years ago would have been considered really low, because we never had anything after 1945 below 70%.
Really?
And there were some elections there where the turnout was over 80%. Then the big shock really came in 2001, when it dropped to around about 59%. It climbed a little to 61%, I think, in 2005. And this time, in the context of a much closer-looking election, that more people had a feeling that, you know, it was really important to get out and vote, then it's gone up nationally to 65%.
Mm-hmm.
But that masks quite a lot of variation, because there were some constituencies where the turnout was still down in the 50s, and there were others where it was well over 70%.
We go next to Greg from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. I'm curious. There's some complaints in the United States about a perpetual campaign cycle with the way we run things. Since Parliament can be dissolved almost at a drop of a dime, is there a similar perpetual campaign cycle going on?
Professor Whiteley?
Well, in a way there is. What we don't have, which is a unique feature, I think, probably of the United States, is the House of Representatives being re-elected every 2 years. That really does make for continuous campaigning. There's a certain amount of continuous campaigning in parliamentary elections in Britain, but it's usual to divide this into a sort of long campaign that's going on at a given level pretty much all the time, parties vying for advantage and trying to score points and so on. But then it really hots up as the actual election approaches. So the campaigning activities this year, you know, from December of last year, have really stepped up a pace as the official campaign approaches. Now, I should explain that the official campaign is very short. It's only about a month. What happens is the existing Prime Minister goes to the Queen and asks for Parliament to be essentially shut down. And if she agrees, then within a month, the election will take place. So the official campaign is very short. But in practice, of course, people are maneuvering and campaigning in the run-up to that.
See, to us, that sounds so strange. You go to the Queen and ask permission, and if she agrees, would she always agree? Is this just a given, or does she really hold some sway here?
Well, the Queen is very careful to try to avoid getting involved in politics. The last thing she wants to do is to be seen as favoring one side or the other. So she's given a lot of advice, but the idea really is that the Queen provides a backstop against, for example, in a parliamentary system, it would be possible for a government, hypothetically, to try to abolish elections and to try to take over. And the Queen is a constitutional backstop that prevents this kind of thing from happening. She doesn't get directly involved in politics, although she's informed all the time by the current Prime Minister, who goes to see her fairly regularly and explain what's happening. But it's a constitutional safeguard, which many people think is quite useful in a system which is dominated by the House of Commons. Remember, unlike the United States, Britain doesn't really have a written constitution. Britain has a constitution, but it's really not written down. It's uncodified. A lot of features of the constitution are not legally defined, but they're a matter of convention. And in that kind of situation, the constitution can be changed by a simple act of parliament. There doesn't have to be constitutional amendments in the same way as the United States. So if it's fairly easy to change the constitution, and if it's fairly easy to do something, you know, that a dominant party might try to undermine democracy, the Queen is there to prevent that happening. And actually, the system works quite well.
This is one of our emails, too. If you could just do a follow-up from Russ in Green Bay. Why hasn't England ever created a written constitution? And from our perspective, his question is, how in the world can you function without one?
Well, constitutions are interesting phenomena. And all of them have informal elements as well as written elements. And this is true in the United States. The most extreme example, if you like, of the difference between practice and constitution occurred in the old Soviet Union, where the constitution of 1936 guaranteed all kinds of freedoms of assembly and freedom of speech and so on, but in fact was completely, was never enforced in practice. It was a dictatorship. So there's always a difference between the formal constitution and what happens in practice. Now, it's fair to say if you compare the United States and Britain, the informal element is bigger in Britain than it is in the United States. And I think that's one of the differences between the countries. And if you have an informal element that's quite important and big, then it's useful to have an institution that can rein this in if the circumstances arise where it might be abused.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email. Professor Webb, let's go to you on this one. A caller wants to know if perhaps Gordon Brown was offered the chance to be deputy prime minister, but he didn't take it because he didn't want to demote himself.
I haven't seen any press reports which suggest that that was the case. I think, you know, the only point in the coalition negotiation process at which Labour was involved was informally actually over the weekend, we know, but formally it was on Monday when Liberal Democrats went and opened negotiations with Labour, and it was pretty clear, I think, from the outset that one of their preconditions of doing any kind of a deal with Labour was that actually Gordon Brown would step down. He was initially prepared to do it in a fairly sort of transitional sort of a way so that his party would have time to go about the business of electing a new leader as his successor. But I don't think at any stage would there have been a suggestion that he should remain in the cabinet, albeit in a different role. Mm-hmm. I think once he'd lost the top job, that was it. He had to ride off into the sunset.
And is that what he does? He rides off into the sunset? What now for him?
That's an interesting question. I mean, he has announced his intention to resign as an MP, as well as, obviously having resigned the premiership. So he really does have, after many years as an active politician, a real gear change of life, I think, to think about. He gave an interview on daytime television about a week or 10 days ago with his wife, in which he actually started for the first time to pontificate in public about this possibility. And he said he wanted to remain active. He still had things he wanted to do. He talked about wanting to be a force for good in some way. And he talked about working perhaps in the charitable sector. So we'll have to see what that actually amounts to. But, he is an energetic and intelligent man at the end of the day, whatever you think of his politics. And I'm sure he's going to find something to channel that energy into.
Right. I'm interested in how the voting broke down when you look at places like Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales. Do they vote substantially different than people in Britain?
Yes, they do. There is a very notable difference between England and the rest in many ways. I mean, in many ways, we actually have quite separate party systems, actually, within the various parts of the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland is radically different to anywhere else, with very different parties. The only one of the main parties, that is, say, Labour, the Conservatives or Liberal Democrats, that even attempted to campaign there in this recent election were the Conservatives, and they didn't do terribly well. They certainly didn't pick up any seats. But you have the Unionist parties there, who basically identify with Britain and want to remain part of the Union with the United Kingdom. And you have the Nationalist and Republican parties who identify more strongly with Ireland. And so there's the, you know, Sinn Féin and the SDLP particularly. In Scotland, you have the presence of the Scottish Nationalist Party. In Wales, you have the Welsh Nationalist Party, Plaid Cymru. And it makes for different sorts of patterns of party competition there. In England, England is really the party of the Conservatives. Northern England is still an area where there are many Labour strongholds, but overall the Conservatives really dominated the election in England in 2010. But elsewhere, that really wasn't the case. In Scotland, the SNP and Labour still do relatively well. Labour still tends to dominate, has dominated for a long time, although perhaps not quite to the extent that it used to in Wales, and so on. So there really are these differences of electoral performance and party strength in the constituent elements of the UK.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us this hour. I really appreciate your wisdom and your being with us for the whole hour to give us a better understanding. Thank you. And thank you, Professor Whiteley. Our guest, Professor Paul Whiteley, Professor of Politics and Government, University of Essex, and Professor Paul Webb, Professor of Government – or Politics, rather, at the University of Sussex. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And there will be more news on this from NPR coming up.